This is Untimely Reflections, a series of conversations with some of my friends, streamed here through the Nietzsche podcast. Okay, so we just watched When Nietzsche Wept, which is a film by... You know, I should have actually pulled that up before we started. But, okay, so I guess we'll just start out with first impressions of everyone. This is my wife, Amberly.
Hello.
She's joining me for the first time on this podcast.
Yep, well, I did take philosophy in college.
You actually went to like a philosophy school.
I went to a philosophy school, and then I took philosophy in a normal school. But I will say... I have, like, my personal philosophy, and that's about as far as I got with the whole thinking about philosophy thing.
Well, you read all the ancient Greeks.
Yeah, and I love Aristotle, and I pretty much, you know, that's as far as I got.
Okay.
And I'm okay with that, but...
Okay, well, and I love you for it. Or, you know, that you can tolerate me being obsessed with all this crap.
Yeah, I can talk philosophy, but it's not my passion. Like, mm-hmm. It is Keegan's.
So When Nietzsche Wept is a 2007 American art drama film. Accurate description and title. Directed by Pinchas Perry. I don't know if that's how you pronounce his name. And starring Armando Sante. Was that Armando Sante? Yeah. Was Nietzsche. I didn't even realize that.
I didn't realize that either.
Whoa, that's crazy. Yeah, so I couldn't help but think, so there was a meme that came out recently where people kind of, or it was like a hoax image where people were convincing everyone there was a new Nietzsche movie coming out, and they just put like Christian Bale with like a mustache, and it just said Nietzsche, and everyone got super excited. But this movie kind of made me think like... I guess just to give my first impression, it made me wish that there was a good adaptation of Nietzsche's life, because I'm not going to say like it wasn't good, but
I'll say it. I mean, it felt like a wishbone reenactment.
It was cheap.
It was very cheap.
I don't know. I was willing to tolerate that though. Like, that was fine to me, like, the production value. Because they worked around, like, we're in modern times.
Whatever. I will say, whatever, Lady Salami, what's her real name?
Lou Salame.
She was, I recognize that actress. I don't know what I've seen her in, but, like,
I think I've
TV,
seen her stuff,
cheap stuff. But
she was in Vikings, according to this. She was in Bones.
Oh.
For a couple of years. Anyway, go on. What are you saying?
Oh, her as a Russian was not believable, especially a Russian in the 1800s.
Well, and it made
and
me
she's
think...
wearing like lip gloss and seducing everyone.
It made me think about Chernobyl on HBO and how glad I was that nobody spoke with like an affected accent. And
that's
the fact,
true.
And I thought about that maybe 10 or 15 minutes into the movie. And the fact that everyone kind of had that, like, slightly affected German, or I guess he's an Austrian, the doctor, Dr. Breuer.
Yeah.
Because I noticed it with him first. And just why couldn't people just talk, you know? And so, yeah, there were decisions like that. So I guess this is what I was going to say. Like, yeah, it looked like a Wishbone special or like a... I was going to say, like, a Sci-Fi Channel original or something like that.
It doesn't
even
look like a sci-fi. It looks like a cheap dramatization is what it looks like.
Yeah, but that would have been fine. I guess what I'm saying is, like, I would have been fine with the cheap look of, like, the sets and the fact that they use a green screen for a lot of things. If they hadn't made cheap... amateur decisions, like.
So
the manic editing.
Yeah, I did make some notes on the editing. So because it was just kind of like really boring. And then when was it? It was when, Dr. Breuer.
Breuer.
And he's like, I'm going to do it for free. I'm just going to put you in my psych ward for a month. It's going to be free. And he's just like, no, thanks, bro. Like, oh, why are you really doing it? And he leaves. And there's like five cuts for Breuer to just be like, oh, fuck. He said no. And there's just like five
you
cuts
counted the no- okay,
for that. No. Well, I didn't count. It's something right, like five. Okay. And I was just like, I even wrote a note that was just like, what the fuck is going on here? But then there was another scene later where it was a dream. So some of the cuts with the dreams I was really digging, like on Swan Lake. The Swan Lake dream was great. It was Nishi and JB, I'm going to call.
Josef Breuer.
He's JB.
Okay. James Bond.
No, just JB. JB and Nietzsche are like in a swan paddle boat.
That was cool.
And there's all kinds of crazy cuts. His pink haired love.
That was okay. That was
Then the sky was on fire. It was.
That was what I was.
It was great.
Okay, it's actually exactly that scene that made me think of a Sci-Fi Channel original, actually. Was like the sky effect and like everything turning orange. But wait, hold on. Like. Her pink hair was another thing that I was like, it's not just that it looks cheap, it's like amateurishly cheap.
Pink. Like, did they have, I meant to know about that too, because I was like, did they even have pink hair in the 1800s? I don't think they did.
I don't think they even had hair.
Maybe they had henna, but they wouldn't have had.
I was going to say pink. Hair dye. Well, but I'm just saying, yeah, no. It didn't look period accurate when a lot of, like, that's kind of the thing, right? I think some scenes did look period accurate, even though that they were kind of cheap looking.
Yeah.
That, there were things like that that just kind of took me out of it, where I was like, okay. Honestly, actually, I was getting flashbacks to, like Hercules, the Legendary Journeys or something like that with the way, or not, you know, like just people who look like just out of place. Like, oh, okay. Everything's period specific. And then somebody just like, is like, wow, you were just like created. You got a set wardrobe. Like that doesn't look right. It doesn't fit in. But,
yeah, like that hair, I'm pretty sure they went to a costume shop and got
right.
A cheap
like she needs to have
wig.
She needs to have red hair. Or something like that. I think it was supposed to be red.
It was supposed to be red, yes.
But anyway, so again, it's not the problem for me, at least, that it was, like, cheaply made, but just that, like, there were weird decisions in there that I didn't quite understand. But, yeah, so the dream sequence, some of the dream sequences were actually really good, and it was, my favorite part was probably actually his pink-haired girlfriend, Bertha. Like, the scenery chewing, I really enjoyed, where he was, like, where Nietzsche's like, now imagine her, you know, spazzing out, or whatever he says. You know, actually, we should probably, before, we've been just tearing into this movie, we should probably actually, like, tell people
what it is.
I mean, so it's basically, from what I understand, the guy who wrote the novel, who was named, Irvin Yalom basically had the idea, like, what if Nietzsche had a psychotherapist? And that's basically just the whole premise. I didn't realize Dr. Breuer's a real person. Apparently,
well,
he is.
This film also, like, I guess not being as familiar with Nietzsche's works, maybe, like, they worked them into it. But this movie really, like, it felt like JB's midlife crisis, like,
rather than when Nietzsche
went. Anything delving into Nietzsche's life. Yeah,
well, and actually, I mean, well, I think we should save this for a little bit later, but I can tell you all the way I was like, well, see, that's the thing, I thought I was going to go down the list of things that weren't accurate, but I could probably make a shorter list of things that were accurate, which
well,
is
one,
another unfortunate thing.
One thing I okay, well, we're gonna do a synopsis now. Okay, so, like, it enters, it's a Wishbone reenactment. We're at a time where Nietzsche has written two books.
He's written more books than that.
Okay,
but he's,
well, there's
got,
two,
like,
books that they show,
yeah,
in the film.
Which I guess one is Human, All Too Human, and the other, you can see, it says Die Fröhliche Wissenschaft, which is the gay science.
And it's before he wrote Thus Spake Zarathustra. And so it follows a time supposedly after Nietzsche was spurned in his love for...
I think they say the year is 1882.
1882. Because he was spurned for his love for Salome.
Who's Salome?
And I guess she left him for Wagner?
No, so that's...
Okay. So
his name is Paul Ray, is the other guy.
Okay.
And Nietzsche calls him my best friend.
And that, okay, so then did the Nietzsche, okay, anyways, later we'll pick that back up. So he was spurned. Okay. He was spurned by Salome and now he wants to kill himself.
And she says that.
Well, he writes to her about how he wants to kill himself because he can't be with her. Classic man move.
That's just sad boy stuff. Yeah. I don't think that's real.
And so then JB, she goes to JB and she enlists him to treat him bodily as a physician to fix his headaches. But unbeknownst to Nietzsche, he's also supposed to do the talking cure.
Yeah, the new talking cure.
The new talking cure. And make him not want to kill himself anymore.
Right. She said, I want you to heal his mind as well as his body. And he's like, you may believe in sorcerers in Russia, but here in Austria, we know that there is no cure for psychological problems. Mm-hmm. And she says that,
him into agreeing with her.
Right. She kind of...
She smiles at him and touches his arm.
He has a weird sex dream with her in it.
Yeah.
Shortly after that. So she is kind of like... seducing him a little bit. But what was interesting, what I didn't know, I actually was like, okay,
are we finished with this?
Full disclosure, I had this book that a friend gave to me and I never read it, but I knew like roughly what it was about.
This book, When Nietzsche Wept?
Yeah, but okay. I didn't know, what I didn't realize was that Nietzsche turns the tables on him. Or no, he actually turns the tables on Nietzsche where he's like, you're going to psychoanalyze me, or you're going to be my psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't say that, but he's like, I need you to help me, Nietzsche, and I'll treat your physical ailments, and you can treat my psychological ailments. And that's how, because Nietzsche initially is like, no, I'm not going to do, like, he's suspicious, and he's like, you're talking cure, I mean, what are you getting out of this?
Mm-hmm.
You just want to dominate me, or you want to aggrandize yourself.
Mm-hmm.
By saving me. So yeah, that's roughly the plot. And then Nietzsche does kind of turn the tables on him because he proceeds to have Dr. Breuer has a complete mental breakdown in the course of the film because Nietzsche, I mean, as yet the other character, Sigmund Freud, points out to Dr. Breuer.
Siggy.
As he's called Siggy in the movie, Siggy Stardust, he tells Dr. Breuer, who he's friends with, he's like a young 25-year-old Sigmund Freud says, he warns him. He's like, by the way, I've read Nietzsche's books and he's the greatest, he has the most penetrating insight into mankind that anyone's ever had. So, you know, watch out. He's going to really psychoanalyze you. And he does. He really gets into his mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much the whole movie. I mean, other than like a bunch of trippy dream sequences and one particular dream sequence that... pissed me off. Most of them did not, because you get used to there being weird dream sequences and weird freak out stuff, and that work, you know, just people screaming and going nuts.
Yeah, which one pissed you off? Swan Lake?
No, so it's when later in the film Sigmund Freud hypnotizes
Dr. Okay, Breuer. We're not gonna talk about that yet.
We'll get to that, but that really bothered me.
Yeah, me too. Okay. But that wasn't a dream sequence per se.
Well, it was a dream sequence in the Hollywood sense of it, and it was all a dream.
Yeah. Some kind of bullshit.
Yeah.
So basically in the film, we have Nietzsche, we have JB, we've got Ziggy, and we've got all these dreams, these crazy ass dreams that JB's having, but he's not talking about his dreams with Ziggy, he's talking about his dreams with Nietzsche.
Mm-hmm.
Ziggy's just there on the sidelines.
Well, he
to just be like smug.
Well, it's funny. So maybe this is a weird reference, but Sigmund Freud would say things like, it's almost as if you need to integrate his conscious and his unconscious. And it's like you as the audience are supposed to be seeing like, oh, this is how Sigmund Freud figured out that you can talk to people as a cure. And it's like, it just reminded me of, I actually thought about this when we were watching it. That scene in Black Dynamite, where they're at Roscoe's chili and donuts, and it's just a complete, like, they're like, chili and donuts don't go together. And then somebody orders chicken and waffles together, and he's like, oh my god, I've got it! It's like, this is how Roscoe figured out that you could sell chicken and waffles. And it's like, it kept, there were numerous scenes where it was like, this is where Sigmund Freud figured out that you can do psychoanalysis.
Yes.
So that was, it was almost unbearably cheesy.
It was very cheesy. And then also, some of the stuff was pretty crazy, too. Like, when Nietzsche, I can't remember when he brought it up, but there was one, like, short scene at the beginning that was, like, Zarathustra. Like, it was when he was describing the book that he was going to write, and it opened with Zarathustra singing in a crowd of people. And I was just like, I haven't read Zarathustra, but I've never pictured just some, like, traveling singer just prancing into a town and singing at people. They make him look like he's from,
you know, B.C. Persia,
where
real-life Zoroaster or Zarathustra's from. But then the whole crowd looks like they're just extras from Austria in the 1800s. You know what I mean? Like, it looks like they, like, I wish they had gotten, it should have looked like, you know, like Jesus going to preach in Jerusalem, like, other, they should have looked like dusty peasants in robes or whatever, and not like.
I also don't think there should have been singing to begin that scene.
Yeah. Well, it was a little weird. Well, also, Nietzsche, like, a couple times he plays the piano, like, really discordantly. And if you listen to Nietzsche's actual music, it's not, like, it's not like that at all. I don't know. They definitely pushed the boundaries of making Nietzsche sing. They wanted to make him, like, really seem like he's this sort of crazy rebel throughout.
Well, so, but I feel like, I don't know. So, watching it in 2021, so it was a film made in 2007, but it's definitely got, like, as a woman watching it, there's just lots of problems because, like, whatever the philosophy I was supposed to get from it, I got, like, JB is whiny, like, and he's, like, there's two manic pixie dream girls in this film. There's Lady Salami, who is Nietzsche's manic pixie dream girl that we don't even get to learn that much about. But then there's JB's red-haired Bertha, who's definitely a manic pixie dream girl. Like, and even there's, like, a scene where Nietzsche is like, don't imagine her like restful when he's like making her like
basic
making
me spaz
because
out,
because he's just like in his mind.
And I love that scene.
Well, but because like they have to acknowledge, like, in his mind, like, he's made this woman to be perfect. Like, she's young and she's beautiful and she's uncomplicated and she wants him and she's tranquil, and that he doesn't appreciate, like, his career and his wife and his three fucking kids. And I think, honestly, and his wife, JB's wife, that's not even, is it, very often, like, makes more fucking sense than Nietzsche or JB, because, like, when he comes home after he's lost his mind, he's like, oh, like, I only get one life, and I didn't know me, and, like, I didn't get to choose my life, and now we're just here, and, like, I have to go choose me before I can choose us, and blah, 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 blah. And she's like, bitch, like, you're a white man.
But Amberly
can read and learn and, like,
right,
if you want, like, I don't get to choose fucking anything. Thanks a lot, asshole.
But you realize that didn't actually happen.
Yes.
That was in his dream.
That wasn't his
which
dream.
Which means that Dr. Breuer is actually aware of his white privilege. Well...
Well,
that's
just,
true, and
the whole thing too, because that
that's
whole
why I
scene,
hated that. That's why I hated that reversal. That was a dream. So,
and but that whole thing was set up. So, as far as I can tell, it goes to being a dream. like right after JB and Nietzsche have the conversation where Nietzsche is like, what if the afterlife is just living your life over and over again, like everything
eternal,
you choose.
Eternal recurrence,
yeah. Which actually is something.
It's actually in the book, The Gay Science, which Dr. Breuer would have read if he did read that book. So that was just one of those things where like, to me, as somebody who knows a lot about this, I was kind of like, I actually really enjoyed that scene. That was one of my favorite. There were a couple scenes with Nietzsche and Dr. Breuer that I actually enjoyed, like on like an acting or like screenwriting level. And that was one of them where he was like, where I feel like that's kind of the point of eternal recurrence, or that it was like a dramatization of like how you're supposed to use that thought experiment. I just couldn't help but think like, but you already read that in his book, dude.
Like, well, also, like, to me, it's not a good way to bring it up because, like, I'm watching it. It's very obvious, a period piece. And then you remember the 18... And, like, first of all, in today's day and age, like, we don't have nobility or whatever, but we also have, like, a huge class divide. And then in, like, the 1800s, also, huge class divide, common people who have nothing. And... like watching this, and especially because the whole movie tilts on like these ideals of women that aren't true, and then Nietzsche sets it up like you have to make these choices again and again, and instead of actually giving thought to this, because I am not really identifying with JB at this point because I think he's kind of an asshole through the whole movie. So I'm not really identifying with him. And then they're talking about how, like, you have to make these choices over and over. And I'm just thinking, like, okay, so what about poor people who, you know, like, maybe they would, like, that would be fucking horrible if someone who was in, like, a rough circumstance who can't control their life has to live it over and over again. And you're not even, like, touching on that. Or, again, then the next scene is him talking to his wife, right, who has much less choice in how her life turns out than he does. And so, regardless of what you're actually supposed to get from the eternal recurrence, like, what I get from it is, like, well, that's, like, they didn't explore that enough, and they gave me a very unsympathetic...
Well, no, it is. Well, so that's why in his notes he actually said the whole point of that thought experiment, he said a doctrine is required for enlivening the strong and breaking the weak. So it's supposed to, if you're like in a shitty situation in your life, I think so this is kind of the thing. There is like a pitiless side to Nietzsche, and that's, but he's not only that. The thing is, this film, I think, is really relying on that angle of him, because it's okay. So just to take a step back, and a lot of fiction about, or like a lot of interpretations of Nietzsche, they take this really one-dimensional view of him as this very, this philosopher who's all about like acknowledging these harsh truths and being, you know, embracing your strength and his doctrine of will to power and this, that, and the other. And then what people really then want to see is, I want to see that guy have a moment of pity, or I want to see him, the whole attraction of this movie is when Nietzsche wept, right? He's this dangerous, like harsh philosopher. And here this is the moment where he weeps. But that being said, I mean, if you just want to get into that idea, I mean, I think he would say, like, yeah, if you can't answer that you would like to live your life over and over again exactly as it has been, like, it sucks to suck, bro. Like, he doesn't really have a nice caveat to that, you know, softens the blow of that at all?
Yeah, well, I'm just saying, again, in more thinking about that philosophy, like, sure, you know, for someone who
you're just saying,
has choices in life, and maybe they are stuck in the humdrum, or if they've been doing what's expected of them.
You're saying you agree with the wife, basically saying like, "Well, fuck your
basically, because when you have choices, it's good to examine and make sure you're making choices you're going to be happy with. But there's a lot of people that don't have choices, and like they just have shitty choices. And
well, and that's why Nietzsche's not really writing for those people. Is the thing. And
yeah,
like a lot of philosophers
you're
try
thinking
to be
about philosophy,
but he's not.
Okay, well, I like universalist.
You're more
philosopher.
Of a Kantian or Aristotelian.
I'm an Aristotelian, is what I am.
Aristotle was in favor of a caste system. So.
Okay. And when I'm the dictator of the world, like, I'm going to make some hard choices. But when I'm just talking about how I feel about these concepts, like, I just think, to me personally, this doesn't really speak to me because it's not applicable in so many people's lives.
But that's kind of the issue for me with a movie like this, actually, is that I don't think they really, so on the podcast, to the people who've been listening, we haven't even gotten to eternal recurrence yet. And that's oftentimes like a thing that people tackle like really, really early. But it's like we've spent now like 15 episodes like just building up on more and more and more ideas that are, a lot of which are related, but and not necessarily because they're easier, quote unquote, but just because I want to give people like a really full picture. And so, I don't know. I guess what I'm saying is like, if somebody is going to take that and dramatize it into a fictionalized movie, I'd want them to have like a real command of the material. And I felt like the kind of, the level of understanding that we are being given of Nietzsche's ideas in the movie were pretty, they're not like wrong. They like a lot of the things Nietzsche says are just literally direct quotes out of his books. And actually Dr. Breuer says that at one point. He's like, "You're just quoting out of your books. Like, why don't you give me an original thought?" So the movie is aware of this, or the movie knows you're going to be aware of it. And they're kind of like revealing that. But that being said, the comprehension of his ideas and like where everything fits in together, I don't know. It didn't seem like anything more than like a pedestrian understanding to me. And that maybe I shouldn't say that as somebody who's like an autodidact, but it was, I don't know. So that being said, the eternal recurrence is probably like the best presentation of one of his ideas that we get. Dude, the cat is, the cat had his face in the cheese. Okay. Well, so what did you have anything, is that something you wanted to talk about next, I guess?
Well, I guess now maybe we could talk on the worst dream sequence. Because, so after they have that conversation, then JB goes to Siggy. And
Sigmund Freud.
He's like, "Do it, hypnotize me."
Well, earlier in the movie, he's like, Sigmund's like, "I don't know if you can be hypnotized," basically. They tease that.
They do tease that. But then, and so then, not knowing that it's now in a hypnosis sequence, JB, like, freaks out. He has the conversation with his wife.
Right.
He leaves his wife and family.
His son, who looks like he's, like, six, is like, "Fine then, Papa, go!" And he, like, slaps his hand away.
Yeah.
And I'm 99% sure those lines were ADR'd by an adult. But, so anyway, yeah.
Yeah, so his wife is throwing his clothes out the window, and his children are crying, and he's like, "I've got to go find myself. You only get one life. You only get one life," he says, as like all his servants are standing around. There's like as many servants as there are family members, at least. Again, talking on wealth and privilege. And so then he goes to find his pink-haired manic pixie dream girl. And so he finds her in a different institution.
Well, he gave, so his girl, Dr. Breuer's girlfriend, well, so she was a patient that they fell in love, and then his wife found out about it and insisted that he stop seeing her. So he said, I remanded her into the care of my another colleague. And so she's at a different...
And one thing, I guess it was a tip-off that it was a dream sequence, because when he's going there, the front desk lady is like, oh, wait upstairs, and he walks upstairs, and yeah, there's stairs that go nowhere.
I thought that was going to be a dream.
And then he had to go to the other side where he could look over the balcony and see pink-haired...
There were several things in that sequence that I kept saying, like, oh, now he's in a dream. But it just kept going and going and going. And so I kept saying, oh, no, I guess it's not.
So I guess that was a tip-off that it was a dream. But then he sees her, and she's making out with an orderly or some random
bloke.
She's
making out with a different doctor, is what I take it. Well, I don't know. I mean, he's a guy in a white coat. Who, like, male authority figure, yeah, over her, she's making out with him again.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure she, like, says the same line to that guy, yeah, that she did.
She's moved on from him. But it's all in his head, so it didn't happen.
So it didn't happen. And then, so he sees her, she's kissing another man, telling this other man how much she loves him. So that's when JB sees her, gets really awkward, like...
Well, also the face he makes, I can't describe it over like just with, I don't know if I can really describe the face he makes, but it's he holds his hand up to his mouth, and it looked like, I don't know, man, that reminded me of like a Red Letter Media acting. Like,
all of it reminded me of like high school emotions, like, like how like a 26-year-old playing a 15-year-old would react. Like, when they were supposed
to... Like, oh, no. Or, like, it was like a soap opera. Like, oh, no, I peeked in and I saw my wife's cheating on me. And it's like... Like, it...
Yeah, but...
It was
but
so
then,
overdone.
Yeah. That, and then also, like, oh, God, what do I do with myself now that I've seen them and they've seen me? And maybe... And I've, like, placed all this love and this woman on this pedestal, and maybe she doesn't return it. So it was, and so he gets really awkward and then just runs away. And so then he's on a train and he's conversing with imaginary Nietzsche.
Yeah. Who even, I mean, the train's an imaginary train.
Right.
But within his imagination, there's also an imaginary Nietzsche.
Yes. And he's like, what have I done?
Right.
And at this point, oh, in my notes. So... In my notes for this whole dream sequence, this is when I started calling this movie JB's Midlife Crisis. Also, I identify with his wife. And then it goes, JB is stupid, which is like when he leaves his wife. That's really what I wrote down. And then, lol, when he's like, when he tells the woman, or when he sees the woman and she loves someone else. And I was just like, lol, that's what you get. And then,
but I mean, well, but hold on, just to push back a little bit.
Uh huh.
He doesn't actually leave his wife. He has a hypnosis dream where he imagines it, and then he comes to his senses. And really, you could make the argument that both the main characters, both Nietzsche and Dr. Breuer, basically come to the conclusion of, like, oh, I blamed my problems on a woman.
You could, but we're not there yet.
Okay.
I'm reading the notes from when I was watching the movie, and these were my thoughts. So, LOL, when he sees the girl that he loved, and she loves someone else. But then, it gets fucking crazy, because he comes back to town, he gets a shave, he gets different hair.
Right, that was great.
He looks good.
Yeah,
the new
haircut. Wish that had really happened.
Yeah, and he gets a new suit, and he looks good in his new style, and then he gets a job at the restaurant that he met Lady Salami, like, that the restaurant that the first scene of the movie is took place in. He now has a job as a waiter there.
And then he sees Sigmund Freud and Lou Salome sitting there,
uh-huh,
and they're like, Dr. Breuer? And he immediately... panics and runs off.
Yeah, and so at this point, I wrote, what the fuck is happening?
Right. Well, no, I mean, and I would... See, that's the thing. Some of the best scenes in the movie were in his hallucinatory hypnosis dream. Like, it just best in terms of, like, most entertaining and actual character development. And, like, his wife having, like, agency as a character.
Yeah.
And, like, all these, and him getting a makeover. All those things happened, they weren't real. And then he just wakes up and Sigmund Freud's like, you are out for an hour.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah.
Well, he doesn't just wake up. So, in his dream sequence, so he's running from Sigmund Freud. Sigmund Freud is chasing him down, like, through a park. Like, the chasing goes, like, there's, like, some cuts in it, but, like, Sigmund Freud is, like, determined to chase down JB. Yeah, yeah. And to get away, JB just jumps into the river and starts drowning.
Mm-hmm.
And Siggy saves him. And, like, is pulling him out of the river, and that's when he wakes up, and you realize it was all a hypnosis dream.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I don't know, maybe that's supposed to say something, but, like, as I'm watching it, I'm like, why did he jump in the river, like, rather than see his friend? What the fuck is going on?
Because it's a dream.
So, yeah, I guess.
It doesn't have to make sense. It's symbolic. It doesn't have to make sense.
Okay, but what is it symbolic of?
Well, no, that's my point, is, like, that... So many of the dream, like the dream sequences, a lot of them are visually interesting in a film that doesn't have a whole lot of like
interesting visuals.
Yeah, I was gonna say like production value, added production value. The dreams are added production value, is what it is. But it is just an excuse to have things happen that don't make sense, or I don't know. Mainly just that one long sequence that I hated.
But yeah, so anyways, then it's all a hypnosis dream, and I guess at that point I was just like, what the fuck movie? Like, and so I didn't even really pick up, because after that is when it just turns into a bromance. So my last note is, the true is that this movie is a bromance.
Right. It ends with them being friends.
Yeah.
With them saying,
which is a callback to a conversation we, the two of us, together had a couple days ago with my family, where I was talking about how occasionally I read fantasy romance novels. And then you were are there fantasy bromance novels?
Right.
Although this
was a Victorian bromance.
This is a Victorian bromance film.
Well, Nietzsche says at the end, he's like, no one's ever said that to me before, which I took to mean, was he saying, like, no one's ever called me a friend, like, said we're friends?
I guess.
So, well, okay, so then maybe this is the time to get into all the bullshit that's in this movie.
Okay, well, let me ask you one other question about
Wagner.
Wagner and Nietzsche. So, in this film, Nietzsche references...
One of my favorite Salami scenes, and actually, Wagner. Is when Nietzsche freaks out. He's having a psychotic episode.
Okay, no, but let me ask you my question first.
Okay, okay.
So, Nietzsche talks about how Lady Salami and Wagner are the two people in his life that he's ever trusted, and they've both betrayed him.
Mm-hmm.
So, if Lady Salami didn't leave him for Wagner, what the fuck did Wagner do to Nietzsche?
That's like I'm going to do a whole episode on that. It's so really complicated.
Was it like...
He didn't really do anything to him. They had a falling out.
But they were just friends. They weren't like more
Wagner
than
was
friends?
Like his mentor, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, Wagner was like... So Nietzsche was a nobody at the time. But he was like an up-and-coming rising star, like professor at Basel. And he met Wagner, and Wagner was, like, world famous, basically. Or, you know, Western world famous.
Uh-huh.
And Wagner, like, both the Wagners, actually, both Richard Wagner and his wife befriended Nietzsche. And thought Nietzsche had tried, actually, his first book is almost, like, people have said that he was trying to provide, like, a philosophy to accompany Wagner's music. In a way. So he was, like, really trying to impress Richard Wagner and really trying to, like, give a philosophical voice to, like, his musical project. But I mean, they basically just have, so they have one scene where Nietzsche has a psychotic break, it seems like, and he's conducting to a chamber orchestra that's not there, while ranting about how Wagner poisoned music.
Yeah.
And he says, like, you tyrant, you anti-Semite. So that's one reason why he broke with Wagner, is anti-Semitism.
And JB is Jewish.
Yeah, Dr. Breuer, well, so is Sigmund Freud. I mean, they're like, you know, they're Viennese, like, there were a lot of Viennese, like, Jewish intellectuals around the turn of the century there. So I mean, like, I don't know, that, I guess if I had a major complaint with the movie, like, from a historical standpoint or just a biographical standpoint, it's that they attribute, it's actually kind of very common, they attribute this massive significance to his break with Lou Salome and Paul Rey, and Wagner is like this kind of side note that, like, is brought up occasionally.
Yeah, I feel like they should have delved into that more, because
I think
it really gave, like, especially because it was just Salome, apologies for always saying her name wrong, I'm not good with names. Salome.
Oh, and, you intentionally are saying.
Yes, I'm intentionally saying salami. Just
say Lady Charcuterie.
Lady, yeah. Well, I'm intentionally getting her name wrong, so I apologize.
Well, you can say that's not the real. You're not talking about the historical Lou Salome. You're talking about the character in this film played by Catherine Winnick, who is Lady Salami.
She is, okay. Yes.
Russian salami.
Russian salami. Because just in passing, and all they do is be like, yeah, he can't trust anyone. His heart was broken by Lady Salami and Wagner. And I'm just like, are you insinuating, like,
that they ran out?
That they were gay lovers, or that...
Oh, wow.
Because that was my first thought, was like, oh, so he...
I thought you were mistaking...
Was in, like, love with Wagner, and then he was in love with Lady Salami.
So he was in love with Wagner, but... as, like, a father figure. Because as he talks about...
They definitely should have given some more context to that. Oh, yeah.
So the dream he talks about at the end, where he's like, I had a dream that my father, like, rose from his grave and, like, took a child back into the grave with him.
Yeah.
And then in the movie he says, you know, I thought maybe it predicted the death of my brother, but I think that child was me. Which is an interesting interpretation of that dream. In Nietzsche's own, like... I think it's in his journals. He basically makes it clear, like, in the dream, he it didn't predict his brother's death. He had that dream after his little brother died. His little brother died when he was, like, 1 year old, like, a year or two after his father died. And so then having a dream...
Wait, pronouns.
Nietzsche's little brother.
Died when the little brother was one?
Yes. Yeah, his name was Carl Ludwig Joseph, and he was, like, a year old, or maybe 2 years old. I don't know, I remember at the moment.
And how old was Nietzsche?
He was, like, 6.
Okay.
5 or 6. And his father had just died, like, a year before that.
Okay.
And so then he has this dream that his father rose from the grave and, like, claimed his son and took him to the grave.
Uh-huh.
Like, which, that has, like, a certain coherence to it when it's, you know, his little brother had just died. And it was like, oh, did he? And, I mean, it's possible they died of the same thing. But so, yeah, Nietzsche never really, I mean, he knew his father, but he died when he was very young. And they actually go into that about Dr. Breuer, that his mother died when he was really young. And that he's, like, projecting her onto his, Bertha, his girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Which would have been the perfect time for... If the movie was about, instead of this Lou Salome thing, was about Nietzsche's problems coming from relationship of his break with Wagner, it would make a lot more sense of, like, yeah, I projected this father figure onto Wagner. And actually, Wagner would, like, died, like, right around that time, too.
Oh.
Yeah. So...
That would have made a lot more sense.
Yeah, but The Lou Salome story is a lot more, like, salacious. It's like, oh, Nietzsche had two best friends, and then, you know, he fell in love with Lou Salome, and then she left him for their other best friend, and, like, that caused the psychotic break.
They should have just become a throuple. Problem solved.
But that's, so, people have questioned that in recent years. I mean, if you actually look at the evidence that's there, it seemed like what actually was... they actually talked about starting like an intellectual commune together,
mm-hmm.
like in the style of Epicurus, of mm-hmm. just get some good friends together and hang out and talk philosophy.
Occasionally have orgies.
I don't think they did that. But Lou, Salome, and Paul Ray like ran off together. And then after that, he was like, well, I guess I'm not going to have my compound of philosophical friends. But it's even the stories of Nietzsche proposing to her may not be true. I've even kind of repeated that a couple times, but I've read some things recently that's led me to believe that a lot of those stories may be overblown. But again, these are stories about like this guy who's portrayed as really hard and tough in his ideas, and then it makes people really enjoy like the prospect of like, oh, he's got to have a soft interior under the skin.
Honestly, I would have actually really enjoyed this movie better if it was set up differently. So I could see like Nietzsche's life doing better service to it in a setup where Nietzsche is an old man, or
I mean, he died when he was like, he did go crazy and yeah. die.
So what was it? What didn't, so he like lived with his sister.
Yeah. But I mean, he was like an invalid at that point.
Yeah.
Like he didn't really have.
Yeah. So to me, this would be a better take because, you know, there's a whole genre of films and it's like old men and then they can't take care of themselves and a young person of some sort comes to take care of them and they form a bond and they talk about it. Mm-hmm. I can't remember any off the top of my head, but like it's a
Frank
trope.
And the robot.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's about a robot.
Yeah. But that's the thing. Old man, young person stories. So if it was later, no, that's not what Up is about at all. if it was later in Nietzsche's life, it was just a random young person
yeah.
and not a psychoanalyst. And then also,
but he was profoundly
you could
crazy.
Well, that's the other thing is so we have that one scene where Nietzsche is standing on top of a piano conducting an orchestra playing Wagner, but it's not real, it's in his head. Mm-hmm. And then in the movie, Lady Salami shows up and she's like tracked him down and she's trying to get him his attention, but he's like too wrapped up in this hallucination to even notice her. And at that point, I'm like, I don't care about JB and his manic pixie dream girl. What the fuck is going on with Nietzsche?
Right.
Like, he's fucking actually crazy.
Which, he was not having psychotic episodes at that time. That was, like, them including that way earlier than it would have been.
So, I think this movie would have been better if it was completely
if
different.
If it was actually about
and
Nietzsche.
It was actually about, like, Nietzsche. And, like, and it could still have these weird, trippy, like, hallucination sequences.
Yeah.
Maybe, like, a what dreams may come sort of, like, thing.
Right.
And then there's a younger person, and Nietzsche is explaining his philosophy to this younger person. Mm. Rather than setting up, like, rather than this whole movie that seems to, like, lose Nietzsche in JB's
Midlife crisis. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how I would plot out or pace out a Nietzsche movie. There's got to be, there has to be a better, more exciting way to do it where you actually just, like, went through the man's life and you could tell it out of sequence or in any number of ways. But this movie felt like it was very much just stuck within, like, I don't know. I mean, it's a very tortured film. just these two people just, like, screaming about their problems and having these manically edited dream sequences.
But not
for, like,
just
two
it's
hours.
Like two, well, I guess Nietzsche wasn't well off, but it's two white professionals.
Why does it matter if they're white? They're from Europe.
Okay, they're white and they're in Europe. So
everyone
I guess
was white.
In Europe, yeah. So if they were two white people in Africa or two white people in China, it would be different. But, okay, so there were two people in their element at the top of their society.
I mean, like, the doctor is. Yeah. I mean,
yelling about their problems. It's all, like, first world problems. It's all,
I mean, yeah.
And
but
I just,
like, the first, I mean, yeah, that's true. But, I don't know. I don't want to get into the history of Austria-Hungary and all their issues here. Like, I didn't personally see it like that because it's just, like, you know. So, for example, Viennese Jews, like, had to deal with a lot of hardship. Like you said, his father had to struggle his way out of the ghetto.
Now, there were some of them. We don't explore that either.
Sure. I mean, there were some of them, like Wittgenstein, who was like, his family was so rich that they literally, like, that was like decades later. But when the Nazis came, Wittgenstein's family literally just paid them to, like, change their race and allowed them to leave the country, which was a thing you could do, apparently. But so some families were really well off. But, like, you know, if you contrast that with somebody like Karl Popper, who was also Jewish living in Vienna, like, he had to flee, and his family, you know, he always kind of, like, resented. So I don't know, this is kind of a sidetrack into other, like, philosophical figures from later on, but I don't know. I just wouldn't necessarily see it that way of, like, oh, these two guys who are privileged talking about their problems, because Nietzsche was, like, an obscure professor who never had any money. He did have a family that wasn't, like, badly off.
Well, but which I think just goes back to, like, making this movie center around JB. And how they did it was not a good idea.
I guess I could see why you would get that impression just from watching the film. Like, within the universe of the film, they just portrayed Dr. Breuer as this dude. Like you said, he's got more servants than family members. He's living in this big house. He's talking about how he's on the top of society. So I don't know. I guess we've been talking for a while about this. Just a couple of things I wanted to say that were not accurate. The very beginning of the movie, he writes Darwin in giant letters on the chalkboard.
Yes.
I don't think that would have happened. Nietzsche didn't really care for Darwin. He did like evolutionary theory, but that was just like a red flag to me from the very beginning of like, oh, I don't know if this person's, like, really done their homework. Yeah, I don't know. I guess I can leave it there for the historical inaccuracies because I could go on.
Because it was
on
the first, like, second of the movie.
Right, but it's like, I mean, I guess I've already kind of said how it just, they run through the heart of the whole thing. Overemphasizing the Lou Salome thing.
So maybe points for accuracy. Nietzsche's mustache was insane.
That was accurate.
Okay. It was insane.
And you've seen pictures of him.
Yeah, I have. But, like,
he's a walrus.
Yeah. Because you watch him talk, and his mustache literally hangs over his mouth through the whole thing. And all I wanted to do was, like, reach into the television and, like, brush aside his mustache. Also, another favorable point to the movie is there's one scene when Nietzsche is, like, walking out to a carriage, and the carriage driver is, like, being...
Oh, I can't believe I forgot about that.
And
oh my
Nietzsche
god.
Nietzsche is like, don't do that to the horses. And he's like, and I'm like, yeah, Nietzsche's all for animal rights. But then, like, that guy shows up in the movie multiple times.
But
afterwards.
You know what that's like a reference to, right?
No.
So there was a... So I've talked about this before in the podcast. There was a story that came out in, like, an Italian, like, a Turinese tabloid newspaper, like, 10 years after his mental breakdown, that, like, the incident that spurred on... They basically said this was an anonymous article that was written that claimed that Nietzsche saw a carriage driver beating a horse in the square in Turin, and Nietzsche ran over to, like, stop the man from doing it and shield the horse from himself and, like, threw his arms around the horse's neck and said, in some versions, he's like, I understand you to the horse.
Uh-huh.
And so that they more or less just decided to just put that scene in the movie.
Okay.
Although it's like, I don't know. See, that's the thing. I didn't understand if as the audience, we were supposed to think, oh my God, this is where it happens. And he has his mental breakdown. Which, if you know anything about it, you would know, well, that happens in Turin, like, 8 years later, so it can't possibly be. Uh-huh. But maybe, like, it was supposed to be, like, foreshadowing of what happens to him later. But the thing is, that's just a, like, from everything I've read, all the evidence points to that just being a fake story.
Well, it was one thing where I was like, you know, save the horses.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think Nietzsche was for psychopathic brutality towards animals, but I think that scene was just directly to...
Yeah, no, it does sound like it.
Yeah. Well, oh, and the thing on the mustache, we should have, like, one quote from Nietzsche in here.
Is it a quote about a mustache?
Yeah. So this is from Daybreak 381. It's called Knowing One's Individuality. Quote, we too often forget that in the eyes of strangers who see us for the first time, we are quite different beings from what we would consider ourselves to be. In most cases, we exhibit nothing more than one particular characteristic which catches the eye of the stranger and determines the impression we make on him. Thus, the most peaceful and fair-minded man, if only he has a big mustache, may, as it were, repose in the shade of that mustache, for ordinary eyes will see in him the accessory of a big mustache, that is to say, a military, irascible, and occasionally violent character, and will act accordingly, end quote. So that's kind of Nietzsche just admitting.
I'm sorry. I know you were reading that quote, but the cat was attacking my leg, and so I did not pay any attention.
All right, this podcast is over.
I'm sorry.
It's fine.
What did it say about mustaches?
Just you can use mustache to hide your peaceful, fair-minded nature. Anyway, so I think it's a confession that his mustache was an affectation. Because, you know, mustache, well, that was considered, he says warlike mustache. That was the style at the time. Like if you're like in an 1800s military. Anyway, so what would you give this movie out of 1 out of 10 Turin horses? How many horses would you give it?
God, stop it, dude.
Sorry, our cat is overactive. He's scratching my wife.
Well, I would give it 10 horses that I would then set free in a field and never make them watch this movie.
Okay. All right. I agree. All right, everybody. Next week, we'll return to a serious episode. But this has been Nietzsche at the movies. Oh, God. He just bit her.
He just bit me.
We need to play with him. He's getting overexcited. All right, everybody. Goodbye.